Hello and welcome to Against the Law, the myth-busting ancient history podcast that aims to separate the fact from the fiction when it comes to the ancient world. You join us today as we play the first in our trilogy that we've affectionately called That's Entertainment. Now, the excitement for this topic was across the board. We were scrabbling around for ideas when suddenly, bingo, we got this ace idea. I wonder if I can risk giving the game away with these clues, though. In our search for historical facts, a trivial pursuit if you will, we chose to focus this week on, you guessed it, games. So let me introduce the players. First up, it's Miss Scarlet in the study with the lead pipe. That's right, we have Xenia here discussing the ancient Romans. Climbing the ladders of fact and dodging the snakes of mistruths, Meg is with us to tell all about the ancient Greeks. Bishop Barney joins us to slide gracefully and diagonally across the podcast to check facts about the ancient Near East. And finally, clomping along like a rusty metal boot, do not pass go, do not collect $200, it's me, Flo. I don't know much about the ancient world, so I'm joining your team, dear listener, as we learn about ancient games. So, like any good nerds, I'm presuming that all of the rest of you like playing board games as well. I'm going to start off with board games because I know for a fact that there are ancient board games, some of which we can still find and play today. So, Xenia, board games in ancient Rome, please.
Yes, plenty of those. And what the Romans loved, unsurprisingly, was strategy games. So one of their favourite ones was called Ludus Latrunculorum, which translates as the mercenaries game. And we don't actually know all of the rules for this. It is mentioned in quite a few different texts, but it's quite hard to, without like literally a rule book that someone wrote down, it's quite hard to extrapolate how you play the game from these references. So the idea is that you have a board and you have like two teams of counters, and the aim of the game is to kind of conquer the other person's army of counters. And so the sources that we have talk about like how you might sort of break through their formation or annihilate them in a massacre. So it's all very, it's military, very military themed. But not all of the games were military themed. You can get giant noughts and crosses. This was another thing that the Romans liked to do with their board games. They liked to take a simple game and then like add layers and layers of complexity onto it. So like they've got a version of backgammon, but you've got three rows instead of two. And with noughts and crosses, it's not just the board of like 3x3. You've got like multiples of 3x3. So you have giant boards, which I think has come down today as nine men's Morris. You get like a 9x9 board as well with counters. So, but the idea is still very simple. You have to try and get a certain number of counters in a row.
It sounds like the Romans would have loved 3D chess. The idea of, yes, 3D chess.
They would absolutely have loved 3D chess. 100%. They would have been all over that AI.
Just like in Star Trek. Just because I have to bring it up in every single episode. 3D chess, three-dimensional chess features heavily in Star Trek. It's almost like they're just trying to prove how smart they can be by adding layers to already fairly boring, interesting and difficult games.
Oh, fighting talk from Flo there.
I'm just saying.
Are you not a fan of board games?
I'm a fan of board games, but chess, drafts, checkers, anything that you can get in a mini version for travel, except Scrabble, can get out of town. Right, so we got the smarty pants ancient Romans. Meg, tell me it's a bit easier in ancient Greece.
I think probably a bit easier. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I reckon the Romans took some games from the Greeks, as they did with most things, just to sort of some more fighting talk here. So the Greeks had a game called Polis, which means city. And you'd play polis with on a board, which had lots of lines on it. And all the pieces were called dogs. So you, like a piece is a dog. And they're divided into colours, so like black and white or blue and red or whatever. And then you had to capture the other sort of sides pieces by surrounding it with your colours. But I think, so it's, it kind of sounds a bit like chess or a bit like checkers. I think more like checkers in the sense that the pieces don't have individual abilities. So it's not like in chess where like the queen or the rook have special abilities. All the pieces have the same ability. So they were big fans of polis. There are some other ones as well, but I think in general in Greece, you can divide them into sort of piece games, as in piece, like pieces, not peace as in the opposite of war. And you have dice games as well. So a kubos in Greece is a die, and pesoi are pebbles or pieces or counters. And pesoi means literally pebbles. I've actually mentioned pesoi before in our toilets episode, which is because they used pebbles as toilet paper. And it's unclear whether the pesoi of board games and the pesoi of toilet paper would ever be, you know, the same pesoi.
God, this game stinks.
Exactly. Or like, oh, we've, you know, imagine if you like, you've played your with your chess pieces so much that they get a bit worn down. You're like, okay, we're a recycling society. Off into the loo they go. So that's quite strange.
Is that where the word pessary comes from, which is medicine that goes up your bottom?
It absolutely is. Greek pesos and then Latin pessarium. Greek pessarion, medicated tampon of wool or lint. Okay, yeah, so sort of stuff you put near your bottom.
Nice. So I quite like the idea that Polis has these dogs that you play with. I like that as more of an abstract thing. There's a story there. Obviously in chess you've got kings and queens and bishops and rooks and what have you, so that's kind of interesting. I suppose there's a story there, but I like games where there's a bit of a story, so I'm more interested in Polis than I am in, say, drafts or checkers, which kind of just are just drafts and checkers. I don't know if there's more lore to that than I know, but I like the idea that there are dogs in Polis, in the city of the board game.
I don't think they were actually dogs, though, or at least that's not what the research has suggested. It's not like they were little figures of dogs like the dog in Monopoly.
On the topic of games with or without a story, do you remember when they made a movie out of Battleship?
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember that.
It has Rihanna in it and Liam Neeson, I think. Yeah.
Sick.
It's another film I haven't seen, but I'm aware of.
I think you'll be forgiven for that one. I hope that many people haven't seen it. But yeah, I wonder what would be the story if they made a movie out of drafts.
Yeah, what's the backstory? There's another one.
There's Clue, isn't there? American movie.
Is there?
Oh yeah.
Because they call Cluedo Clue, and I've never quite understood why. It's a really annoying one, the Cluedo Clue change, because Cluedo is a pun, right? It's based on Ludo.
Oh, I never got that. Board game puns.
Meg, did we talk recently about Trivial Pursuit being an excellent pun?
Yeah. Trivial, yeah.
Yeah, a trivial pursuit, a pursuit of trivia, but it's also ultimately ephemeral. But yeah, no, Ludo, because Ludo means I play in Latin, right? And it's also a game.
Oh my God. So we've got board games in ancient Rome. We've got board games in ancient Greece. Can we complete the trifecta of ancient board games with Barney?
Yes.
Yay.
I shall not elaborate.
Okay, great. Moving on.
There's a couple of very sort of key board games from both the ancient Near East and Egypt. And I think actually a lot of them have been picked up quite a lot in popular, I'm going to caveat popular here and say like board game culture, because I don't think like board game hobbyism and pop culture necessarily overlap that much. But yeah, there's been quite a lot of interest in Senet, which is the famous Egyptian game, and the royal game of Ur, which is the Mesopotamian game. And I think the royal game of Ur has had a Tom Scott video maybe dedicated to it, where he plays the game against one of the curators of the British Museum, at the British Museum, called Irvin Finkel, who translated a tablet that he found in the collection that allegedly has the rules on it to the Royal Game of Ur. And then Senet, I noticed there's a board game publication that's been named after it, which I think is quite nice.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah. But yeah, I can go through the sort of basic ideas for each of those. Senet, the rules aren't exactly known, but it's sort of a race game, you know, like Snakes and Ladders is a race game.
Oh yeah.
Right, so trying to get from 0 to 100, trying to get from A to B, whatever, and thereby win the game. So Senet has a board of 30 squares and your pawns move across it. The rules aren't unfortunately clear, but Senet itself in Egyptian means passing, so it's called the passing game. They found about 120 boards for this over the years, and I really quite like the sort of different types that they've found. They don't change very much over time. So like across the sort of 3,000 year history of Egypt, the Senet boards were the same, more or less, from start to finish, which is really impressive, I think. But yeah, so they're sometimes found as just slabs of stone or boxes in which you can keep the pieces underneath. Or my favorite is the graffiti versions, where someone has scratched a Senate board on the wall and then, or on the floor, and then played sort of in the wild.
Oh, I love that. Is Senate the game that I'm thinking of where there's, I'm imagining like a really beautiful turquoise box, like you said, with squares on it, and then there are like two sides of pieces, because I'm pretty sure I heard about that in primary school, and it's really stuck with me, this lovely turquoise box.
I think you might be picturing the British Museum version of the Royal Game of Ur.
Oh, right.
Because that is beautifully blue and has the two sets of pieces that race alongside each other.
It is rather gorgeous.
Yeah, I can come to that in a sec. But the interesting thing about Senate is that whilst it was played recreationally and very much as entertainment, clearly if it's being like scratched in the ground, probably just by some bored person who wanted a quick game whilst waiting around for the heat of the day to pass or something, it also had a sort of ritual role and was played in a funerary setting, like adjacent to tombs, possibly because the movement of the pawns across the game board somehow reflects the journey of the soul through the underworld.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's one of the theories for how the game was played, not just as entertainment, but also as ritual.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I think it's really nice. And so you have this really cool hybrid of the sort of the sacred and the profane in one little object.
In the cloisters at Salisbury Cathedral, there's a few etchings, which includes, I think they're probably done by choir boys waiting to go in. One of them is of a sort of fairly cute but also quite ugly cat, but another is of a crisscross shape, and I think it's probably like a draughts or a checkers board that the choir boys of Salisbury Cathedral throughout history have made their mark on the side of the cloisters so that they could play a little game of checkers or draughts while they're waiting.
Just on that note, there's a game called Five Lines, which is big in ancient Greece, which I can say more about in a bit. But just really on that, they have found sort of bought like game tables for it in temples, in the ruins of temples. So that's clearly like throughout history, people are bored at church and playing some games. It's so lovely.
I wonder if they've been cursed because they didn't have the full attention desired during church services or temple services.
Yeah, or it might have been part of it, like Barney's saying. It might have been, you know, almost, it's absolutely fine to play a quick board game in the temple.
I've always found the single post-it note to be a very good board for a quick game of noughts and crosses in the middle of the workday.
That's a good tip.
Slide it across the desk.
Nice.
Noughts and crosses is one of those games that you play with some, you always pick someone who's like, I know the method actually of how to win noughts and crosses every time I play. Same with Connect Four. I always pick that person to play noughts and crosses against, so I've given up on it now. Way that you can win every...
Only as the starting player, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Barney, you're the sort of person I don't want to play against because you know how to win. So I mentioned earlier in the podcast, if there's a travel version of it, I don't want to play it. It sounds like Senet and Ur both have travel versions where you can put the pieces inside the box and take it somewhere else. So maybe I need to walk back that statement.
Did you want to hear a little bit more about the Royal Game of Ur?
I really do.
Yes.
Cool. Okay, so yeah, the boards are very similar between Senet and the Royal Game of Ur. And although the Royal Game of Ur is named for the southern Mesopotamian city of Ur, where they have the big ziggurat, which is where this extremely beautiful version of it that's in the British Museum was discovered, the range of the game is really massive across the ancient world. Some Senet boards in Egypt had the board for the Royal Game of Ur on the other side, so you could flip it over. A bit like now how you can do like chess and draughts on the same board, for example. And it's also found over in the Indian subcontinent as well. So that's a pretty huge range across large parts of Asia, excluding the Far East. So yeah, big range on the Royal Game of Ur. And that's also a race game. And two teams of pawns compete against each other to get round the board, a bit like backgammon. And they come into conflict with each other if they're trying to share the same space. So other pieces will then be sent back off the board to start the race again. And as with all things Mesopotamian, they couldn't resist in the ancient Near East getting a little bit of omens shoehorned into the game.
Mm.
And because some of the movement is randomized through dice rolls, there was that element of unpredictability to it. And so there are omens that derive from where the pieces move and how they move across the board. What I think is quite nice about that is obviously other than the Mesopotamian like obsession with trying to read omens in the natural world, is considering that like luck, which is basically what dice rolling is and is a key element of most games today, was considered by them to be like a channel for some divine communication.
So like casting runes almost.
Yeah, yeah, in a sense, yeah, and seeing which way they land. But I just think, you know, luck is a pretty integral part of a game. And actually a lot of modern board gamers like don't like too much luck in a game because it, you know, it reduces your ability to strategize. But yeah, I think that's really interesting that like luck is a pretty key gameplay mechanic and they're seeing that as an opportunity to read something into the supernatural world.
So I'm more intrigued in sort of the rules of these games and if I can play them now with my buddy. So have we got any games that we maybe could speculate as to the rules for? Because I'm aware that you don't get a nice box, a cardboard box with a pamphlet inside to tell you how to play like Settlers of Catan. Meg, you were talking about Five Lines.
Yeah, so Five Lines, we don't know the rules 100%, but we do have some visual evidence, like the instructions of the Settlers of Catan, that might help you work out the rules. And this is another tabletop game, a bit like Polis. So there's a sort of board, and there are five lines, as the name suggests, on the board. And then you move counters between and across those lines, and you probably roll a die, we think, to work out where to move your counter. And the winner was possibly the first person to put one of their counters on the central line of those five lines, and it's called the sacred line. And apparently there's a sort of Greek proverb that's like moving the piece from the sacred line is sort of a last resort option, that if you're losing the game via another way, you could move a piece off the central line, which obviously isn't what you want to do, but it's a sort of last resort, like no other options. So that's quite interesting that it sort of gives rise to like a saying in ancient Greece. But we can, one of our bits of evidence for how to play this is that there is a vase painting, really famous one, which shows Achilles and Ajax playing what we think might be Five Lines. We're not sure what they're playing, but it's a lovely painting. They're really kind of, they're still in their armor. So they're sort of fighting the Trojan War, but they're having a little break, playing some board games. And on the vase painting, it shows Achilles saying that he's thrown a 4, but Ajax has only thrown a 3. So we know that Achilles is winning this game of whatever they're playing on the vase painting. We should definitely tweet a picture of it. It's really, really cool. And they've still got their spears in their hands. They look like they might be about to go fight again, but they're just having a quick break to play the game.
I'm going to go from Five Lines now to Five Lions, because not all games were board games. Some games were a little bit more physical and possibly a little bit violent. Senya?
Yeah, so I think when we do think of ancient Rome and the idea of games, then probably the first thing that kind of pops into our heads is the gladiatorial games, or games in the Colosseum, or even chariot racing as a game. But the reason why I don't want to go into that massively today is because I think we've covered it quite a few times in different contexts and different episodes, and there's quite an overlap between that and sport as well. So the way I'm looking at that kind of angle of it today is by participation. So people tended to view gladiator fights or animal hunts or whatever as a spectator sport, except this one time when the Emperor Probus, so he's a bit later on in Roman history, he planted the Circus Maximus with trees and bushes so that it was like a forest. He released several thousand herbivores into it so that there was no risk of anyone being mauled by a lion. And then he let all of the spectators into the Circus Maximus to go and hunt for the animals themselves, and they could take home whatever they caught.
That's great, but I don't fancy my chances against most wild animals. I think I read a fact somewhere that 6% of Americans believe that they can take on a lion in a fight barehanded. Not barehanded like rawr, but like empty-handed.
Barehanded.
I wish I had that confidence in myself. I like to imagine that, you know, you sort of take part with your friends like it's paintballing, and your friend comes out with a lion, another friend comes out with something else quite fierce, and you come out with like a hamster, and you're like, bad luck today, guys. So that's very physical. That's not, that's like, so that on the scale of 1 to 10 as a sport or a game to take part in, that's more strenuous than paintballing, and definitely more strenuous than going in one of those bouncy balls that that you have. You seen this, that you can go inside a big inflatable ball and roll around and play football and things?
Zorbing,
that's it. See, if the ancient Romans had zorbing, they'd be zorbing around a stadium full of lions.
They would love zorbing, actually. I feel like that is such a Roman thing to do.
It has to be strategy zorbing, though.
There's got to be a rhyme and reason to it. Outzorb the gladiator if you can.
Yeah, got to push the other zorber into the Tiber or something.
Yeah.
But that does remind me of Aristophanes's thing in Plato's Symposium, where he talks about how originally humans were like two people smushed together back to back, and they had 8 limbs, so 4 arms and 4 legs, and they basically like cartwheeled everywhere. That just reminds me of that idea.
Oh, I remember them days. Getting to school was tough. So that's a very physical game. Have we got any other evidence of very physical games to take part in the ancient world? I'm counting myself out here because I would end up leaving with just a hamster. So I'm going to say that I've pulled a hamstring, or maybe like Achilles, my heel is weak and I can't take part.
There is a game that Ovid, it's not physical per se, but Ovid says that it could lead to physical encounters. Basically, he encourages, not far off, Ovid encourages women to play Duodecim Scripta, which is the one that's like backgammon, because he thinks it's a really, it's a good dating activity, like the amount of time and effort and conversation that you can put into playing it might lead to love.
That's some of Ovid's better advice, right?
It is.
Like, that's reasonable from him.
It's better than going to the theatre where you can't talk because someone will tell you off for it on a first date. And then so you've just sat together next to each other, possibly with a creeping arm. I think that's better advice from Ovid about how to have a good, successful date.
Good. I'm glad you approve. Yeah, he genuinely does have another part of his poem where he talks about going to the races to pick up girls. And yeah, he talks about sort of using the excuse of moving the cushion to gently touch her knee or...
Okay, no, it's bordering into Andrew Tate vibes. Don't like it anymore.
Absolutely.
Changed my mind. So, Barney, do we have any physical games that you might want to play without a board game in your area of expertise?
Well, considering what Xenia just said about not going into too much detail about, like, you know, Roman games and gladiator combat and that sort of thing, because we talked about it before, I think it's a little convenient, actually, that during that episode, I think either it was in my research and didn't come up, or only came up in a very limited capacity, that there are these sort of games involving lion hunting over in the ancient Near East, most famously in the Neo-Assyrian Empire, where the kings of Assyria, especially Ashurbanipal, would depict themselves, and, well, you'd assume, and actually do, hunting lions as a statement of their power. And this is a pretty key piece of iconography from throughout most of Mesopotamian history. Is the sort of the mighty ruler fighting animals, right? Sort of dominating the natural world. So that's normally like wrestling with a lion or wrestling with a wild bull or something like that. And yeah, clearly a projection of their strength and power. But what's interesting about Ashurbanipal's lion hunt, which is depicted on the palace walls from Nineveh, it's a very, very graphic description. I've definitely mentioned this on the podcast before. Like, the lions, as they die, are sort of like vomiting up torrents of blood. And it's highly naturalistic in like a fairly disturbing way. But I think what's cool is that the more that you look at those palace reliefs, the more you can see how much this is very much like staged, this spectacle. You know, lions are easy enough to tame, right? So these were probably palace lions that were being unleashed and were maybe too hungry or too tired to actually fight anybody. So the king wasn't really dominating nature in the way that he might have liked, and more sort of projecting this ideology of power without any huge risk to himself. So yeah, amongst the reliefs, you can see one of the handlers releasing a lion from a cage, for example, and he's in his own little cage on top of the lion cage, which I quite like, this sort of stack. And there is a public element as well. One of the other panels, you can see that there are people on a hillside nearby watching, and there's a tiny little lion and a tiny little king that you can see depicted inside the palace further back on one of the hills. So there's a sense that these are sort of attended, if these are real public events. But yeah, to my mind, instead of the sort of entertainment that we were talking about earlier or Xenia's participation, this is very much like spectacle in the sense of like slightly fabricated, slightly more controlled, and therefore a bit more ideological than the other things we've been talking about today.
I find it desperately sad that these poor domesticated lions are like, oh, people, are you going to give me a sandwich? Ah, you've speared me in the head. You know, that's quite sad.
Yeah, it's very cruel. And there's a mistake, I think, that you could make. And I think this is something that the British Museum draw attention to in some of their labelling for these reliefs. In looking at how unpleasantly the lions are dying, you might kind of think that maybe there was some sort of sympathy being shown to them by the artist who carved these reliefs. But I don't really think that's the case. And I think it's more just,
look how well we killed them.
Exactly. Look how well we've dominated this chaos here. Yeah, and they are the chaotic element, right? Because lions did used to exist across the ancient Near East, and they would have been a real problem, a bit like wolves maybe in Europe, out in the steppe where they would harry farmers. And so, you know, traditionally kings and their troops might go out and actually clear up the lion problem in the countryside. So you can kind of see where this expression of kingship ideology has come from.
It's a bit like the opposite of the game in Europe where you put a goose up high and then ride a horse underneath and then try and yank its head off as you go underneath. Geese aren't really known for their natural predatory vibes.
Pretty violent though.
It is pretty violent, but you know that it's like Europeans are like, oh, I've defeated a goose.
The mighty goose. But no, I think isn't that a disparity between the Europeans' perception of goose combat and the Americans as well? You know, you mentioned that survey earlier. I think the same one had how many Americans thought they could take on a goose, and it's way higher than people in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, well, so in the UK we're brought up with a sort of innate fear of geese and definitely swans. I mean, one fact that we all know about swans that has been drilled into us from a young age is
they can break a man's arm.
Swans can break a man's arm.
Isn't that from Adrian Mole? That's my memory of where I've learned that. But maybe he's got it from somewhere else, you know?
I think the strength of the goose may predate Adrian Mole.
I think so. I've fed geese and swans, and it's very pleasant. They're quite polite. I fed them out of my hand, and I had a strange Doolittle-style bond with the swans. That's just me boasting about my affinity with swans. I think I was probably safe feeding the swans, though, because I'm not a man. And as we all know, they only break men's arms because they can break a man's arm, but not a woman's. So I was safe.
So, Barney, when you were talking about the kings and the lion hunts of the ancient Near East, that reminded me of something that Hadrian did. So when he travelled around the ancient world, he really liked to sort of delve into the histories of the places that he was going to and imitate them. So when he was in the Near East, he decided to have a lion hunt himself, and he was with Antinous, his lover. And there's a panegyric poem written about this lion hunt. We don't know if it's like actually what happened in this lion hunt, because it is a panegyric poem, which is a poem that's supposed to be kind of in praise of whoever it's being written about. So yeah, it's a little bit of a sort of suck up type poem, but it's quite cool. It's very dramatic. And the idea of the poem is that Antinous finds the lion and he wounds it, but then that just makes the lion even angrier. So it starts attacking him, and then Hadrian rides up and he spears the lion and he saves Antinous.
My hero.
Yeah.
Xenia's hero.
Oh yes, I can't lay any claim.
You can't, she's called dibs. So usually when I finish an episode of Against the Law, I ask what everyone's favourite fact was that they learned. But in the spirit of games, I want to ask everyone, what is a game they would or definitely wouldn't play? Meg, to start off with. Meg, what is a game from the ancient world that you'd love to or would hate to play?
I would love to play, and in fact have played the Royal Game of Ur. You can buy it, right? Like, my grandma had a version of the Royal Game of Ur when I was little. And it's so fun. It's really addictive. And it was one of the only games that I was better at than my younger brother. So I don't know what that says about me, but I love that game.
That is very, very reasonable. And Barney, since you brought Ur to the table, literally and figuratively, I'm going over to you.
I think I would get involved with a bit of Zorb hunting. if I could.
Our imaginary game.
If that existed.
If that existed. I really like Xenia's story about the participatory hunt in the Circus Maximus. But yeah, I probably wouldn't want to get involved with the killing of animals necessarily. So maybe if I was in a Zorb, I could just sort of shunt them around a little bit.
So you're strategizing already.
Yes, 3D chess Roman strategy hunt game.
Nice.
Catchy.
It'll catch on real quick.
Oh, yeah.
Xenia, I'm coming to you. What is a game that you would love to or hate to play?
I would be interested in playing Meg's Five Lines game as long as the pieces were not used as toilet paper.
Yeah, that is a very good point. You don't want a...
I can't make any promises.
A poo counter. I'm more interested in whether they might be considered counters first and then poo scrapers, or poo scrapers first and then counters, because that really does have an impact on how likely I am to play. I quite like Five Lines, I do, but I'm going to go with something that I definitely wouldn't play, and I definitely wouldn't play a game in which I have to betray the trust of a poor domesticated lion who's just trying to probably have a cuddle and a sandwich, and instead was met with a cruel fate. I definitely wouldn't like to play that, but I would like to play the Royal Game of Ur, Senet, Five Lines, and then Xenia's game that is like backgammon, but I can't pronounce. What is it?
Duodecim Scriptor.
Yeah, that. I would love to play all of those games. I think I'll stick with board games personally rather than the physical. So that was today's first part of our That's Entertainment trilogy. You can join us next time for more Against the Law. If you've enjoyed today's episode, you can always choose to support us on Patreon.
We've got all sorts of tiers for every budget, starting from just £3 a month. Benefits include getting each episode a day early, stickers, and your name in cuneiform.
You can find us on Twitter at Against Law, and you can also find us on TikTok at Against the Law Podcast.
We're also always happy to hear suggestions, questions about the podcast, and other requests. If you want to email us, our email is againstthelawpodcast@gmail.com.